have a timeout. Decide not to use it. Curry, way downtown. Bang! Bang! Oh, what a shot from Curry! With 0.6 seconds remaining.
The brilliant shot. Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He scores! Australia have got it!
How are you, Doc? We have had 5 minutes of discussion before this where you tell me how bad my openings are, so I thought I'd stick to my bad openings and just talk bullshit instead of saying hello.
Case in point, the last 30 seconds. Hello, folks. I'm sorry you had to listen to that. I'm the Doc. He's Bezo. We are the Balls Podcast. We are talking to you live from the internet at a time that was recorded in the past, so this is a time capsule. In this time, Australia are 3 down for 70-odd-ish.
Mm. With a day to go?
With a day to go and going off a light, playing Sri Lanka, doing their best to lose a test match that they should have won by not batting badly on the first day.
Or today. 3 for 70?
Well, it's a little bit like we were saying, I don't know if we mentioned this last week, but when you were eulogising Misbah Ul-Haq, even though he's not dead, we neglected to mention that he, in the second dig in that first test match that Pakistan won against England, he got caught on the boundary, or second ball, when Pakistan really needed to make solid runs. And David Warner seemed to have seen that and said, no, I'll do one better, and he got bowled second ball. So Warner has all the substance of a wet fart.
Well, so they're talking about bringing in this test championship with the two tiers, which... I really like because
it needs a jingle. Test championship.
Because it'll actually give some of this stuff a little bit more meaning. You know, like losing a test like this might actually be quite problematic if you were trying to get that number one spot.
Yeah.
And sort of like this is the thing. Back in the days where there wasn't much coverage of overseas tests, you could take...
Well, there still isn't. As we discussed last week, you can't find highlights. And the only way to watch this game is illegally.
Yeah, and I'll get back to that. I want to cross back to that. But you can follow all the writers that are there on Twitter and on there. You know, there is a media presence of it. There is ways to interact with the game. Like once upon a time, Border took a test team to Sri Lanka, and would have anybody known that they were in Sri Lanka?
You would have read the story in the paper and maybe heard radio news.
Yeah, but two days later or a day later, like you definitely couldn't, you know, see ball-by-ball coverage on five different websites, and you definitely couldn't see, you know, Peter Lalor and Jeff Lemon and those guys commenting from the ground about the light and the way it was turning and whether the pitch looks dead.
No, but you could have got ABC Radio. And that stuff was much more straightforward. You would have got ABC Radio.
For a Sri Lanka tour?
Yeah. All the overseas tours you used to always get. I mean, they used to always have radio coverage.
I thought it was only for the bigger ones. But anyway, I could be wrong.
I could be wrong, the Bezo story.
Yeah, the Bezo story. But if there's a test championship and dropping a game like this, it can have real consequences.
It brings some of that sort of English Premier League pressure to it because every game suddenly matters, even though you're away at fucking Norwich on a wet Wednesday. It matters as much as...
That's right.
As everything else.
And that brings me to... the sort of tradition of you pick your best side, right? And Warner, if you're playing a 5-test series at home, Warner is definitely in your top 6 batsmen. He's a monster at home on Australian pitches.
He is literally a flat track bully. He will bully the shit out of you on a flat track.
Yeah, which will win you games, like games that you might not ordinarily win because
there's a lot of tests are played on flat tracks. There's positivity in the term flat track bully as much as there's negativity.
Yeah, that's right. He's a little bit like Hayden, except Hayden could do it on some non-flat tracks as well, where he would just...
Hayden had much more stick to activity than Warner does.
But
Hayden had some fucking steel to him that Warner doesn't seem to have temperamentality in terms of. I'm making up words now tonight. It's fucking Captain Thesaurus night.
Warner Warner can take a game with you, but at what point, when all of these games start mattering, do you go, well, okay, we're playing Sri Lanka, it's going to spin, Davey, maybe go and play the Caribbean Premier League this time, buddy, and we'll take...
Maybe go on this A tour to somewhere where it also spins and learn for next time.
Yeah, well, that too, or, you know, like we've talked about endlessly, you know, turn Adelaide into Sri Lanka and turn, you know, Sydney into India. And
That's kind of the point, isn't it? Because you say, okay, you'd pitch Davey off, but...
Yeah, that's right.
Khawaja played a fucking shocker as well. Who? And he would be the most equipped to face this kind of stuff. And that's not just racial profiling. That is just because the way he plays the game, yeah, he's got those
soft hands. And
he's
even
got those wrists.
Even
subcontinental
even Smith,
wrist, Roy.
In the first innings, like dancing down the pitch to the guy that's looked pretty dangerous and trying to swipe him over, you know, like he was playing at the Gabba.
It's T20
day one.
Temperament. Yeah, it's T20 temperament. They don't have the fucking patience.
So I wonder whether that two-tier importance of winning every test everywhere you go might change some of the preparation and selection policies of Australia. I don't think it will. I think it's so ingrained that you sort of pick your best 11 players no matter what the conditions and... those players should do well in those conditions.
My concern about that system would be that we might be more likely to see a lot of negativity. In that if we were on the brink of relegation and we needed to draw a test series, that the entire nation would shut down. The pitches would be roads, and it would just...
And that's going to be
the spectacle.
That's going to be the challenge of the system. You know, there will have to be tweaks to make sure that if you're going to try and get a 1-0 test series in a 5 test series because you want 4 draws and you'll play one game because you've got 4 good fast bowlers, you'll stack the Gabba and then just win that game and draw everything else. There's definitely challenges, but I like it better than the system that they've got now where
nothing matters.
Well, nothing matters, but I think that the Pakistan first test and even the second test against England in this game, what I've noticed... and
we'll get to that test too.
What I've noticed is there is a lot of general interest of I've seen a lot of interest from non-Sri Lankan, non-Australian people on Twitter for this test.
General cricket fans,
because it's a really interesting test. Mendes, Harath, you know, bowling. Like, I just saw one of the ex-Australian guys go, you know, I wonder what Harath runs the 5K in, because he's obviously fit. He's bowled like a million freaking overs in this test and looks like he's just going to keep bowling and bowling and bowling and bowling and bowling and bowling until they get him all out.
Rangana Harath?
It is, yes.
God, he's been around for a bit.
He has, and he doesn't look like an athlete, but he's got the endurance. Like, his
must
fingers
be better on his decks than he is overseas, because he's crap everywhere else.
Yeah, well, and sometimes you just have a good series. Sometimes you're just that little bit fitter, and you can bowl longer spells, and you can work guys out. But he didn't bowl particularly well in England, so
yeah. I think they've come off having their asses kicked.
Yeah,
and they really want to get back to their own decks and make the most of it. And they've done a good job, and they've hit an Australian side that tends to not respect oppositions they don't rate. And that's exactly what you've seen here. They clearly haven't wedded themselves to it psychologically, and have batted scatterly, and, you know, they've bowled well in the first dig at least. But
the young kid that's got the runs, like, he's got one first class century.
170 odd, wasn't it, from a 19-year-old?
And like, he was high. He's a highly rated junior, and they're expecting big things of him. But it's not like we're putting a pop gun attack out there. That's Stark and Hazelwood, and Lyon's got more wickets than any off spinner in Australian history. It's not like
I think that's kind of dabbing with faint praise there. That feels like, you know, you're the best at being slightly, you know, you're the best at this very crap thing that we don't rate very highly. It's like a hot dog eating competition. Congratulations. Yeah, we're really thrilled. Being an off spinner is kind of a skill. It's the thing you'd I mean, anyone can bowl off spin. Off spin's a garbage skill.
Yeah, except for huge chunks of our test playing sort
of recent test playing time, we've had nobody better than him. And we've desperately tried to find someone. But like, we haven't found him.
In between, like, we've had sort of gun leg spinners, but there hasn't been a gun leg spinner in the side all the time.
We've had gun probably leg spinners more in the history of Australian cricket.
Yeah,
or if you count Clary Grimmett, who was a Kiwi.
And for the rest of the time, we've mostly had off spinners. You know, Taylor, May. Well, yeah, they haven't been that great.
Because off spin is generally shit unless you cheat, like Morley.
I don't think
because really all you're doing is tweaking your fingers, and that's not going to generate enough revs to do anything interesting.
Yeah, but you only
unless
got
you
to
can articulate your wrists in a weird way, like Morley could.
You don't have to move it sideways. You've only got to move the ball, the width of the ball, to cause problems.
Yeah, how many off spinners have bowled a team to victory? Not many. I'll save you the bother. Not many, if
okay.
any.
I think Graham Swan might disagree with you, but anyway.
I don't give a fuck what Graham Swan does. What's he up to right now?
Well, he's retired, mate. He took 300-odd wickets and retired.
Yeah, bowling for fucking England. Mm. I mean, he did that on purpose.
Bowled
for England on purpose.
They did beat Australia quite a bit while he was a bowler there.
That's
but funny. Anyway.
Let the record show Bezo is now a Graham Swan apologist. Disgusting depths to which this man would sink.
I'm drinking the greatest of all beer, which is beer
for
that
its gold.
Beer that you win in a bet.
Wouldn't know about that because every bet that I've made regarding beer has not been honoured.
That's because you keep turning up here hungover and won't drink.
I was pristine. I was pristine as a motherfucker.
So I'm drinking a lovely.
I drank my own fucking beer.
I think I drank your beer as well last time you were here, to be honest. I'm drinking a lovely Port of Fremantle Sail and Anchor Golden Ale. It's quite nice.
I think I'm drinking some kind of Moa Pacific Pale Ale.
I was going to say, what happened to your 19% beer that you've been drinking on the podcast?
Oh, I've got some of that, but I've also got some Bird Dog, which is Emerson's Freak IPA that's really good. Emerson's have just... this is probably more of an After Dark thing, but Emerson's have just opened their new, massive new brewery and they've got a restaurant and a cellar door and all that sort of stuff in there. And they've been completely overwhelmed by the demand. But they've got Bird Dog, which is one of my favourite beers of theirs, on tap. Bird Dog's actually named after a Dunedin Sound album. This is definitely After Dark.
Of Dark Stuff, yeah.
Yeah, we'll put a line through that. But I have beer, but I'm drinking other beer because I already had it because I was waiting for you.
Fair enough. So what did you want to say about the Pakistan-England game?
Were you just going to wrap up the Australia-Sri Lanka game?
You're going to lord it over me that you were right about them batting first.
I know, I was going to say is that he's exactly right. They're about as good as each other, give or take, plus or minus. And the team that won the toss got the advantage of the conditions and batted was going to win the test match. And that was the case in the first test. And that was, you know, that's basically where it is. And also, Cook and Root fired in the first innings for England, and that's how they got to be at 500. That's basically... So, being carried by Cook and Root is fine if Cook and Root are going okay. And that's pretty much what you've got.
Well, definitely, I think, like, Root, you can sort of put him down for his average, because he's delivering consistently, you know, over a long period of time. But Cook seems to be... a little bit like a lot of captains in their later years, you know, Clark, Ponting, a bit hit and miss.
And he goes big against the crap sides.
Yep. And that's... Pakistan aren't a crap side. They're number three in the world, so...
Yeah, but a lot of that's based on,
No, they've beaten...
If Pakistan came down to Australia, would it be 3-0 or 4-0 or 5-0?
Well, they're playing a three-test series here this summer. Make an early prediction.
3-0.
I'll say 1-1.
They're going to get annihilated.
You reckon? No. Yeah. I don't
know. Australia
don't...
at home are the ultimate flat track bullies. They'll be fine. There've only been one test series where they really looked horrible, and that was the Ashes series they lost. Name another Australian test series where they looked troubled, let alone beatable.
They lost to South Africa not that long ago.
No, I think they drew, and that was about 6 years ago now. That was a long time ago. That because it was fucking.
They lost.
I can't remember the dude. The dude who saved the game in Perth when they were chasing 400.
They lost that series.
He's actually retired now.
They lost that series. They lost that series because they lost to South Africa.
What was it, 2-1? And then they went over to South Africa and beat South Africa.
And then they won. Yeah, they beat South Africa at home, which everyone was so annoying.
But that was such a long time ago now. That was like 2011.
Yeah. Well, you would argue that the Australian side is worse than the side that lost to South Africa then.
Look, I don't think this... I think at home an Australian side's going to... They just don't lose at home. That's kind of the problem. Australia are too good at home at Test cricket. If they actually were challenged at home, then they might get better and be travel better. It's odd that we've got to a state in Test cricket where, even though we have more international cricket being played than at any other time, teams are now worse at travelling overseas than they were originally.
Yeah.
Back in the days when you had to get on the boat for 5 weeks.
Well, the Cricket Status Hour podcast did a little bit about that, you know, because there's this sort of thing about... You know, you need to come and acclimatise and play lots of games in the country and get used to the pitches.
That's true. Nobody plays decent enough enough tour matches anymore.
But they had some of the longest. Zaltzman went through some of the longest tours that Australia did of England, and there was one they played 14 tour games. they basically played six counties before they played the first test or something.
What was that, 50s, 40s?
Yeah, 80s, 90s? One of the days, back in the days when they used to get on a ship to go over to England.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were obviously wanting to make it worth their while, but they lost every test. They got annihilated. And evidently that was a side
When was that then? Because...
This was a side that went over as favourites. I'll have to look it up. I think we've got it in their show notes.
That's going to be a long time ago because that wouldn't have happened any time in the Bradman era.
Might have been the last series before the war or something.
Any series that had Bradman in it, they wouldn't have lost every test. I can't believe it.
Yeah, or maybe they lost 3-1 or something.
Keith Miller and all those sorts of fuckers.
But it was a side that went over as favourites and they played lots of games to get acclimatised and then didn't win the series and didn't win it, you know, it wasn't like 2-1 with a very close fought third game. It was like they got beaten.
The bodyline series happened in Australia, didn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, so it wasn't that serious.
No. What did you want to say about the Pakistan series?
Oh, nothing more than what we said was that we were right.
Yeah,
was that the teams are probably about as good as each other, and
you wonder whether the thing about the
basically just to pump the brakes on all the my God Pakistan are tremendous, you know. Kimber writing fucking eulogies about Misbah's captaincy, leaving out the fact that he held out on zero and all that sort of
except
stuff.
We can all just
calm the fuck down.
I think both things can be right. Like, it's still pretty impressive.
Two contradicting opinions can exist at the same time. Yeah. Have you been on the internet? Yeah. Of course they can't.
Because I don't think losing that test takes away from the fact that they beat them in the first test. I think that's still an achievement on its own.
It does, but I reckon the third test is more likely to be an England win than a Pakistan win.
Well, I think
momentum, which is something that Bill Barnwell doesn't believe in, but
if you do believe that playing at home gives you an advantage, right? So you would say that playing at home gives you an advantage.
But there's a complication in that when you're playing a team like Pakistan where. They're very comfortable playing at your joint.
Well, they never play at home.
Well, and also you've also got a team that some of them actually come from England. A lot of them probably play county cricket in England.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and there's a large element of the support who are your peeps. So you don't feel I think England is a pretty good place to tour. If you're any country, because there are people, and probably Australia to a lesser extent,
but
certainly England. There's a lot of Pakistanis, a lot of Indians, a lot of West Indians in England. It's probably a relatively benign place to tour, if not for the fact that they've got a ball that hoops like a motherfucker.
But generally in cricket, you would say the home side has an advantage. Yes.
So, well, it should, and if it doesn't, it needs to talk to its fucking groundsman.
Right. So, you normally play three or five test series, So just give the, just say, the visiting team gets to pick whether they bat and bowl more than the home team. So you have.
I think the away team should always get the choice.
Yeah, or you have three. But I don't mind it being 2-1. So, you know.
Yeah, but how do you decide which two and which one? Because it might be.
Well, one. The away team picks first, then the home team, then the away team. You're giving the away team two picks at the cherry. You're giving them the chance to win first up.
But if you know, if you're say the if you're Cricket Australia, and you know the away team get to pick first.
Yeah.
How are you going to juice the conditions so that you're going to make a very even pitch for the first? You're going to make a very one-sided pitch for the second, and whoever gets the choice is going. Like you would make a, say for Brisbane, you'd make a road. For the second test, let's say it's Hobart, you'd make it green and juicy, knowing that your team's going to win the toss and put them in, roll them for 90-odd. And so the problem is if that's specified, then we've got a problem.
Well then,
and that's the same problem with what I just said. If the away team always picks, then
the same thing's going to happen. You're just going to produce dead decks that produce draws.
Yeah, that is a problem.
Like the other way that you do it is you've already got an international panel of umpires. Go to an international panel of curators. Don't let.
That's not going to work because. Who's going to pay for these dudes to fly around the world? Because they've got to live in various parts of the world for six weeks, 12 weeks, 4 months.
You know, unless you sort of rotate them around.
It's not that broken.
No.
You know what would be easier? Flying pitchers around the world.
Well, I was thinking about the four-day test, right? Because this test's going to go 5 days, but you basically lost... almost a whole session out of every day because of rain or bad light. So it's
I don't know if this is a good time of year to be playing Test cricket in Sri Lanka. I don't know what their local climate is, but they're not that far from the equator and the weather's not that good.
So if you look, so they've actually produced a test that is pretty conducive to the bowlers, right? Fast bowlers and spinners, like there seem to be a fair bit of movement for the quicks as well. You know, that's the answer. If you want to have four-day tests... you've got to leave a bit of life in the pitch for the bowlers. You can't produce flat decks because otherwise you're not even going to get close to a result.
Didn't flat decks used to be a dance act that were around in the 90s?
Fat decks, mate. Fat decks.
Flat decks.
Close. Flat decks would make a really good parody version of it.
Yeah. They're almost atonal. They just go...
I'm not... if you got the change to the pitches that went with four-day tests, I'd be all for it because when the bowlers can actually do something, Test cricket is really enjoyable. But watching batsmen just rack up hundreds is pretty fucking boring. Like,
I'll tell you, this Test match, I haven't been able to watch any of it because the rights aren't available in New Zealand, but this Test would have been much more interesting than any Test in which either side makes 500 or 400.
Yeah.
Any test where the batsmen have to scratch for runs is automatically more interesting. And then have to counter-attack. And some of them do it by trying to hit out. Some of them do it by just gritty, fucking bloody-mindedness.
How much more memorable is Mendes's 100 in this game for the fact that no one else got 50?
We got like 170 out of what would have been what they'd lead by 260. They were 80 behind. So what did they get? 340?
So they got 353. So yeah, he got half their runs.
You got half the runs. That's right. During the innings, he was they were tweeting. Was Liebke and various others were tweeting about the fact that he was challenging Bannerman's record for the proportion of runs out of a completed dig. But he was killing it.
The 10 and 11 got a few runs. I think sort of put paid to that. But
I'm sure he's heartbroken.
Yeah. Well, especially like if it doesn't rain tomorrow, they've got a pretty good chance of winning.
It's going to rain tomorrow.
I just wanted to. You were talking about the lack of coverage, right? And this is where I think we probably talked about this before, but
we have definitely talked about this before. But it's worth banging on about again because it's fucking stupid and it needs fixing.
Well, but it's not just so you and I follow a lot of people that are interested in a lot of sports, right? But the NBA is the only sport, right, where something happens and instantly my timeline on Twitter or the people I follow on Facebook, mostly on Twitter because I follow a lot of basketball people, just floods.
Yeah, I mean, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, but yeah.
Oh, but I follow a lot of cricket people and a lot of rugby league people too, and something interesting will happen in the cricket and they will tweet, you know, oh my God, that's an awesome wicket. He's just bowled one back through the gate with no Vine. And I'm just like, what the fuck? I want to see it. And you go on you get a Fox Sports or whatever to look it up, and you eventually can find it. But basketball, something happens, and instantly there's 15 different angles and pictures of it and video
the
of it.
The NBA will tweet it to you. The actual account of the fucking league
will
send you a picture of what LeBron just did. You know, they'll do.
And the fact is that it violates all their broadcast agreements, and the NBA...
No, it doesn't, because it's built into their broadcast agreements. They have it, I mean, the NBA have it built in to say, like, we'll do this. Or ESPN will have it built in to say, like, we can share this stuff on social media. It's interesting that the... what was the tournament? It might be the Olympics, but there's some sport that has sorted out to do that for Twitter for the next tournament.
Yeah, right.
And that makes perfect sense, because that way you open it all up to Vines and fucking GIFs and all kinds of gear.
Like, you're creating interest. And especially, like, I'm not going to buy Fox Sports to watch Australia play in Sri Lanka. And unless you're completely fucking insane.
And I'm not even
going to
buy a fucking Cricket Australia pass, because I looked it up on the web and they said, oh, we can't give you that.
Oh, really?
We can't, because you don't live in Australia. Fair enough. So if I want to watch this game, all I have to do is look up fakeillegalstreams.com and I'll just watch it for free, and your fucking sponsors will get donut from it. Good job, fucktards.
There's no Australians living or travelling overseas. Like, we all just live in Australia.
We all live in Australia and we watch Channel 9 like we're told to.
Get
fucked.
I don't know if you read the Gideon Haig piece that I sent you.
That you sent me. I tried it. It was fucking boring. What the fuck are you sending me that stuff for? That was the most boring shit I've ever read. I've ever tried to read. Look, folks, he sent me this bit that was about sports governance in Australia. And it was this long piece about how sports governance is difficult because it's in between amateur sports style, you know, the club where everyone's nominated and volunteers and all that sort of stuff, and corporate stuff. No shit.
Mm.
Why did we need 30,000 words on that?
Oh, no, I thought it was pretty interesting, but I think the...
You're weird.
I am weird, yes.
That was the worst thing I've ever read Gideon Haig write, and he's written some fantastic stuff and some crap. That was in the fucking ladder column.
Well, I actually think it comes back to a point that I've been making or been... thinking about for quite a long time.
Been waiting for you to actually justify that thing.
Which is government funding for sport should be for participation, not for elite sport. If elite sport can't work out a revenue stream for itself, then it deserves to die. Off you go. If you can't attract sponsorship or TV money or advertisers...
You got a disclaimer this given your role with Touch Football, or are you just going to... nothing to do with that.
No, touch football's not. It's got fairly high participation, but it's participation sort of. I was actually thinking more in like netball, and netball has a huge participation base, but gets very little funding dollars. It's not an Olympic sport. Olympic sports, right, get huge amounts of...
Can I hold this beer up to the microphone and let you smell the beautiful citric hops? It's got a nose like a pine for us, this thing.
I love citrus in any alcohol. The Olympics get a huge amount of dollars, right? They don't have that high a participation rate. It's all in the elite. It's all pushed to that. So how's that actually helping the government money... Like the Olympics,
and the point of the AIS is, I mean, this the AIS was formed after the debacle of the Montreal Olympics, where Australia won fuck all, and it was the national embarrassment that led them to establish the AIS, which tells you that the point of winning Olympic medals has got nothing to do with sport and everything to do with national dick swinging.
Yeah.
But so it's only ever going to be the sports in which the most dick swinging can occur that get funded. It's not never going to be the base of any kind of equitable return. It's always going to be the ones in which they can swing their dick and say, look at us on the fucking medal tally. We're fourth.
I think the AIS is a separate thing entirely, because AIS is taking people that are already close to the top and pushing them that little bit further.
Yeah, but only certain sports go into the AIS.
But that the information from the AIS trickles out to a lot of sports. Like, touch football is not at the AIS, but the stuff that there is a lot of stuff that comes out of the AIS into sports like touch and netball, basketball.
Did we explain what the AIS is?
It's
the Australian Institute of Sports. It's a horrible fucking gulag in Canberra. If you ever do a tour, I did a tour of it many years ago on a really cold, windy Canberra day. And it was like visiting a Soviet gulag. It was all these horrible little concrete bunkers. And I felt like, it was almost like I was going to see these dreadful fucking propaganda posters, like Strength Through Joy and Solidarity of the Workers and all this sort of shit. It was amazing. It was the most horrific fucking place I could ever imagine.
If it was a proper athletic Russian gulag, it'd have any injecting rooms in it. So
It would. And a nuclear power plant that just went to the nuclear.
I don't mind the AIS because that's sort of taking the elite and pushing it. But what I think the government funding, like the AFL gets a lot of fucking government funding. They're an elite sport, and they get it for not for their grassroots stuff. They get it for their, you know, the big teams. I'm sorry, if you're on TV, you're supposed to be the biggest sport in Australia. If you can't look after yourself, then tough. Pay your players less. That money should be going to...
No, don't pay your players less in a salary cap league. We don't want to be advocating that. Pay everyone else less.
Yeah.
Because the players are already getting fucked. They're not getting compensated for the amount of income they're bringing into the sport in any salary cap league. You can take that as written. You know, in the NRL, the players of the rugby league are not earning as much as the money that is coming into the tournament. In the NBA, that is certainly the case as well.
Mm. Well, it's in the eight.
In the AIDS. People have got AIDS.
In rugby league, that's a little bit hard to prove, but in the NBA it's not, because it's written into the contract that they only get 48% of their income. So
I thought it was 50.
No, I think it's only 48.5 or something. It was
almost exactly 50-50 from the last CBA.
I thought it was
the last collective bargaining agreement. Sorry, folks, we don't want to...
I thought it was 50-50 the last time, and it dropped... this
and no,
CBA.
It dropped from like 52 or something.
Ah, right, down to
so
50.
So it's close. It's pretty close to 50-50, but this is going to be the sort of thing. There might be a strike coming up in the NBA, folks, in a little bit. The end of next season, because the current collective bargaining agreement expires, and the players and all the owners might be unhappy with the way things are going. Because right at the moment, there's been massive... Since the last collective bargaining agreement, there's been massive increases in the amount of money that's been splashing around the place. And they probably need to sit down and renegotiate where they are. Teams are now selling for billions of dollars. Players are now earning $20 million a year, where before they were earning nothing of the sort. And they probably need to set the terms of engagement a little more carefully. But there is a risk that... if they don't sit down and actually come to terms, that there might be work stoppages, hopefully in the pre-season and not in the actual season. The last time we had work stoppages in the actual season was a couple years ago. The actual year escapes me.
Was it
the first LeBron Miami year?
Yeah, I think it was the first year.
So that's 10-11, I think.
Yeah. I think if it's going to be a strike, it won't come from the players. I think there's too many players earning far more than they ever thought that they were going to earn. While I'm sure there's a lot of players at the pointy end think that they could earn a lot more, I think your average NBA player is pretty happy.
Well, as long as they're feeling they're getting the cash. The trigger point for a labor stoppage or some kind of a lockout is what they call it in America, where the owners lock out the labor. will be probably small market owners who feel nervous about how quickly player salaries have accelerated, and nervous about their ability to sustainably pay those salaries, given that they're always going to get less money from regional TV and things like that.
Well, it was interesting. Zach Lowe on his last podcast said that he's
Mark Stein, was it?
Yeah, he talked to a lot of league guys who had sort of said, okay, the cap's going to jump this much. Take player X. He was getting $8 million under the old cap. He probably is worth about $12 million under the new cap. And then this year, a whole heap of players got well above what the sort of collective idea of what they should have got was. So this year, a whole heap of people got overpaid.
Yeah,
Which
my heart bleeds for them.
Oh yeah, like both those guys were like, eh, good stuff. But that's the weird thing about the NBA is
what's Jalen Rose's line? You never get what you deserve, but what you have the leverage to negotiate. That's exactly right. I mean, you never feel bad about a player who gets overpaid because the owners ain't giving you money back.
I find it
those fuckers are raking it in every day. If you can make bank one day, good on you.
I find it really funny that two of the best writers in the NBA, who would not be on, you know, million-dollar salaries, I wouldn't imagine, from ESPN, were like feeling sympathetic for Dion Waiters for leaving $6 or $7 million on the table. I'm like, dude,
off the table.
He's still getting $4 million a year.
Because Dion Waiters had an offer from the Thunder to stay, and it was a good offer. But then when Durant left, the Thunder quickly whipped that offer off the table because they wanted to change around what they were doing to make sure they were in a position to offer Westbrook a good deal in the future. So Waiters suddenly is in a situation. And Waiters is a shoot first, ask questions later Muppet. He loves himself.
And to be fair,
and he's
terrible.
That deal has been sitting
there for 3 weeks. It's not like they sort of went, here it is. Oh, no, we're taking it away. It had been sitting there for 3 weeks, and he thought that he would get more on the open market.
Basically, he did a stupid thing and lost out. But he's gone to Miami now, isn't he?
Yeah, and this is the thing.
He's joined Pat Riley's fucking Island of Misfit Toys.
Let's put this into perspective. He lost out. He's still getting $4 million next year. I don't know about you, but I'd quite be happy to lose out that way.
Well, if you were being paid, let's say your salary was $60,000 a year, you're being paid $30,000 a year. How happy are you?
Yeah, not real happy.
Given that you've got a lifestyle built around earning $60,000 a year.
But you know, who knows what Waiters thinks? He could be thinking anything.
He has his own fucking island.
Yes,
we know this. They've spoken about it enough. What do you mean it's not a real island?
So, have we got any addition to the Red Bull screwing over Australians this week?
No. It was a fairly quiet week, I think. Oh, God, I can't remember.
No,
the last Grand Prix was so fucking boring, I can't even remember it. No, Ricciardo got a podium. He actually
did a really good,
he had a good job. He did well off the start. He was competitive. And he... This is the part of the rope-a-dope from Red Bull that makes us think, oh no, they're not about to get dirty at all. This weekend, so there's two Grand Prix in a week. So last week was in Hungary, which is a horrible go-kart track. For some reason, has been on the calendar for the last 30 years. This weekend is the German Grand Prix at the gilded Hockenheimring. It used to be a flat-out blast through the forest and is now another fucking go-kart track. But it's Dan Ricciardo's 100th Grand Prix.
Yeah, I didn't realise he'd been... how many are there a year?
Well, this year is a record. There's 21 races this year.
So he's, I suppose, 5 years, 5 or 6 years?
Yeah. It doesn't seem like he's been around that long, but he has.
Yeah. It sort of seemed like Webber retired, but I suppose Webber's been retired for a couple of years, hasn't he?
Well, this is his third year with the Porsche, Le Mans program, the World Endurance Championship is what they call those Le Mans style sports cars. Webber actually had a win on last weekend, was their first win of the year, and I think basically their first points of the year, because they'd blown up or broken down in every race so far. But Webber and his guys, Brendan Hartley and Timo Bernhard, were world champions last year, and have been fucking awful this year. Just shit out of luck wherever they've been. Broke down at Le Mans and crashed out at Silverstone and various other shit. But they got a win at the Nürburgring last weekend while Formula One were at Hungary. So Webber's been out the game for 3 years now.
Yeah, right. Hey, did you want to talk about the Tour de France while I go and get another beer? Because I don't know.
Say? Do you want me to have a little rant while you go and get another beer?
Yeah, no, it's all right. But Froome, is
Chris
it three
Froome's
in a row?
Chris Froome's a boring cunt, and he's the problem with the Tour de France. Yeah. Previously, everyone was cross with the Tour de France because it was full of dopers. Now it's just full of dopey people, boring cunts who nobody likes. Chris Froome is like a skeleton on a bicycle. The only exciting moment in the entire tournament was where it looked like he might get disqualified for running up the fucking hill, and he didn't.
Is there no one conceivably that's going to knock him off? He just seems like
the last guy who could beat him was actually his countryman, Brad Wiggins.
Yeah, right.
He was better than Froome. He won one tour and then he, you know, got a bunch of gold at the Olympics and he went, fuck, I'm done. That'll do me. And he just went, fuck it, you know. He just couldn't be bothered.
Look, I can totally... you know, I like sort of both ways. I like the Tim Duncan way where you just go, I really enjoy playing. And if I can still play and contribute, I'm going to keep playing. And I also like the other way where they go, hey, I've done everything I want. I'm out of here. See you later.
Casey Stoner model. Yeah. Because he got in, won a couple of championships and just went, oh, fuck this. I can't be arsed.
Yeah.
I'm going to go fishing. Yeah. And that's what he did.
And that's the thing. If you've earned millions and millions of dollars, why not? Why not just go fishing if that's what you want?
I've got a hot wife and I've got a young kid. I can't be fucked. I'm done. I actually saw a doco on the last couple of years of MotoGP on a plane that I think it was on a Trans-Tasman flight. I've forgotten what the name of it's called. I think it's called Hitting the Apex. It's narrated by Brad Pitt, but it basically looks at sort of 2011, 2012, 2013, which were sort of very tense years in MotoGP, because in 2011, that was Stoner's second championship, but it was also the year that Marco Simoncelli lost his life at the Malaysian Grand Prix. And it was very, very... I mean, it's actually the... Dear listener, I know that you tend to be a little bit vulnerable on planes, but it's the last time I cried was watching that movie on that plane with a moment when Simoncelli, unfortunately, they actually used the footage of him sliding down the road with his helmet knocked off. It was just, motorsport is dangerous, kids. But it was sort of like 2011, 2012, 2013, which was the first year of Marc Marquez. So it was, reminded me just how dramatic and tense those years were.
Yeah.
But you can see why, seeing that, someone like Stoner would just go,
I'm out.
No, I'm good. I think I'll go home. I'm going to go fishing. And then the funny thing is, at the end of the movie, they had like the running captions of, you know, everyone was Marc Marquez went on to win such and such, and Valentino Rossi is still winning at age 37. Casey Stoner is still fishing. Such a lovely touch. Spoiler alert if you ever watched that one.
I'll be really interested to see what Duncan does, because everyone sort of just assumes that he's just going to ride off into the sunset and no one will ever see of him again. But
fuck off, we make a fantastic coach.
Well, that's the thing. A guy that plays 19 years in the NBA and 4 years of college before that must like being around basketball clubs, or he wouldn't do it for that long.
He could be a really good player manager, a really good coach.
Yeah.
He could be a really good agent.
Yeah.
He could certainly teach players how to take less money. Hang on, I can't see this working.
I think he'd actually make a good general manager because.
Yeah.
I think that's how he's
player
brain,
conditioning.
Brain would work. Yeah, though they've signed another old guy today that can't defend, which makes me wonder what the fuck they're doing. So,
place holding. They're doing what the Knicks are doing,
that's
but they're just doing it quieter.
Mm.
Hey, Buzz Rothfield's a fucking dickhead, isn't he?
Yes.
So rugby. Sorry, writer for the Daily Telegraph.
Well, hang on. That's Buzz Rothfield of Cronulla. That's a bit strong.
Okay.
Writer.
Crayon eating fucking window liquor for the Daily Telegraph. Buzz Rothfield, who was a Murdoch stooge, turns out that he's been on the take from dodgy fucking gambling types for quite some time, and dodgy gambling types have been saying, "Do X and Y and Z, or I'll get my mate Buzz to fuck you up in the paper."
You in my
There's
newspaper.
No suggestion that Rothfield was aware of this. But it certainly was being said by gambling type.
But it's not being denied that he was giving information to this bloke. This bloke was betting big amounts of money and then passing the winnings back to Rothfield.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what's been going on.
That is absolute truth.
And Rothfield has always been known as a dodgy, as a fucking flog.
Yeah.
An absolute fucking flog.
But the funny thing is that he came out and said, there's nothing wrong with that. What's the problem? I gave him some tips. Those tips came home, so he shared the winnings with me. You're a fucking journalist, mate. You're supposed to have ethics, and that's not ethical.
Yeah, but he's a Cronulla supporter.
Well, that is...
You know, the worst club in all of Sydney.
In all of Sydney? In all of the rugby league?
Well, you know, there's always
I think I hate Cronulla more than Manly now.
Oh, I always hated Cronulla. The thing is, Cronulla went to Super League, so that automatically made them worse than Manly. Mm. And Manly disappeared up their own arse for a while. But Cronulla have always been scum. Mm. And the people of Cronulla voted for Scott Morrison. So fuck those cunts.
Jesus Christ. I didn't realise that.
But yeah, that's his electorate. The Shire. Oh. The Shire is Scott Morrison's electorate. People like Buzz Rothfield voted Scott Morrison into power. Can't. So everyone called Buzz in Australian sports media is a complete flog. That's my working theory. I've got Rothfield, I've got McNamara, I've got a theory but basically I've proven the theory by induction, N+1.
Wow. All right, have you got any other sporting
takes?
I've
got a
few
more takes. Something that's fucking worrying and shit. So the US Olympic Committee are trying to ban non-sponsors from sending tweets that tag Rio 2016 or Team USA in there. They're going to try and sue anybody who hashtags Team USA or Rio 2016 in their tweets.
Just in case you weren't aware of what the Olympics was all about, which is blatant commercialism instead of sports.
And also, apparently, they've also said that anyone whose primary purpose is not media is not allowed to tweet or communicate any Olympic content, which technically means that you and I couldn't retweet the US Olympic Committee.
Yeah.
Saying, look at Michael Phelps being shit in the pool. Look at Michael Phelps literally shitting in the pool.
I put in our accreditation papers. Didn't they come back yet?
Yeah, they...
Oh, are we not going, said, are we not going to Rio?
Oh, God, I hope not.
But I've paid for my tickets.
No, they said Peter Allen instead.
All right.
This song was quite convincing.
I had a bit of a text conversation with Pat, who filled in on the podcast the other day.
The other day, five weeks ago.
Are we sure the Olympics are going to survive? I'm not that sure.
I think they'll survive. I think they are shrinking in terms of cultural relevance.
I reckon we're one big drug scandal during an Olympics away from the whole thing just fucking collapsing.
No, I think the thing is people want it's a bit like Eurovision or the World Cup. People want an event and they don't really care how the sausage is made. They never cared in the old days. They don't care now. They didn't care when the East Germans were sending, you know, female swimmers who looked like refrigerators. They don't give a shit.
Yeah,
you know, people just want a big event. Now, the thing is that the Olympics is sport for people who don't like sport. So it will live and die by the free-to-air audience of the major broadcasters in the biggest countries.
Okay, so that was
if the Americans stop watching NBC for the Olympics, then they've got a problem.
Well, Americans are just stopping watching NBC altogether. Like,
yeah, but this Olympics is in their time zone, so this will be an interesting litmus test.
Yeah, that's right. So it'll be if the free to wear pool starts shrinking, which means the advertising starts shrinking.
Yeah, because they're never going to get enough advertising for. I mean, they can put all of the Olympics on all of the pay TV channels, and they do, but the ratings for that is going to be granular. You know, there's going to be people watching the football and people watching the darts and people watching the fucking the three-legged race and whatever else is on.
Yeah,
it's so granular that it's impossible to advertise to.
I actually think that the follow-up article to Gideon Haig's article is the one that we've been talking about for ages, is that those small sports are just, and I'm talking non-Olympic sports, niche sports, surfing, mountain biking, touch football, they're all just chipping away at the pie. And it's so insidious, and it's coming from, you know, it's not like the A-League versus the AFL. Like, the AFL can see the A-League coming. They can see that there's a giant stirring underneath the waves that's got this huge international appeal, that's got lots and lots of fans. Like, that's something that's run. That's the Mack truck with its headlights on coming down the highway at them. You know, they can see that coming.
I think it's a Falcon Ute with a broken fucking headlight, basically. Then the A-League. It's not quite a Mack truck. Oh, we should pour it a little out. The last Falcon Ute came off the production line at Broadmeadows today.
Yeah.
The end of the Falcon Ute.
Well, there goes donuts at the top of my street.
Well, to be fair, Ford invented the Ute. Hmm. So the first ever Ute was made by the Ford Motor Company of Australia.
Yeah.
They decided that, okay, maybe if we do that, if we just sort of cut it at the arse and make a tray, that would be a thing. So there is a little bit of significance.
It sure wasn't like a drunk worker on a Friday afternoon going, look at me with me fucking power saw, mate. I'm going to fucking cut the back off this car.
I think that's probably more likely than the official Ford story, which was that it was the wife of a farmer wanting to.
Oh, right. Yeah, no. I'm going for
it was 1926 and some cunt wanted to do circle work.
I'm going for it, mate.
Fucking loving it.
I'm going for a drunk factory worker with a circular saw on the shop floor.
And yes. Fully sick, mate. Fuck off.
So I just don't know whether. Maybe it won't be a sudden death. Maybe it'll just be the pool of advertising will shrink and no one will want to host the Olympics anymore because there's no money in it. And
like, well, I think you're right. And I've been thinking the same thing, is that this is going to drift into irrelevance. It's going to because all the really big sports are going to give less and less of a fuck.
Yeah.
And all the little fringe sports are only ever little fringe sports, and they're going to get chewed away by the fact that they're all, you know, attention is so fragmented.
Well, take basketball, right? I've always been a massive fan of basketball in the Olympics. And I used to, like, some of my favourite Kobe Bryant stories is how he used to really get into the Olympics, and he would go and support the US synchronized swimming team and the indoor volleyball team.
He was just trying to perv on some coy, let's face it.
But he would just go and, you know, he got right into it. And I liked a big sport sort of going and helping a whole heap of niche sports. Because if Kobe Bryant turns up at the archery, then all of a sudden the US archery team get an article in the paper that they normally wouldn't have got. But the thing is that a lot of NBA players skip the Olympics because their clubs want them to be focused on the NBA season.
Yeah.
So for international...
Well, because they're carrying injuries from the NBA season, which is what we've seen a lot of.
Yeah,
Steph Curry, and that's probably fair
enough. But there would probably be a few niggly injuries that might be borderline on keeping them out, maybe.
Yeah, true. But if they had an international tournament that mattered, if say they were coming into the Euros or the World Cup style with football, then it's much more of a pull and push. It's sort of, well, the club might want me to stay out, but I've got to fuck off and I've got to represent my country in a serious tournament. The Olympics isn't.
No, not like the Olympics for the US basketball players is an opportunity to go to the Olympics, not And and represent your country.
And fuck gymnasts.
And not necessarily to you're not going there for the competition. But if they went for, because they were talking about a world champs that would be half owned by FIBA and half owned by the NBA.
Yeah, now, David Stern tried to start this up, didn't he?
I think it's seriously in the works. Now, if that happens, then all of a sudden there's pressure back on the clubs to make sure that even, you know, players that are even slightly injured are available for national teams, because then the NBA has an invested interest in France becoming, you know, a big grand final between France and the US or Australia and the US in 8 years' time.
Yeah, but you can still be derailed by other things. So say if that big world championship was going to happen in next summer, which is the summer of...
Free agency,
the summer of labor disputes.
Mm.
There's a whole lot of other shit and noise going on that would really conflict the clubs. I mean, in reality, they can only really give a fuck about what they do.
But I think,
clubs don't have any allegiance to the NBA. The same way that clubs in the EPL don't have any allegiance to the Football Association of England and Wales. I think it's just England, actually. Sorry, I'm thinking of the cricket board. So, I mean, Arsenal don't have any allegiance to the English FA. So they're not going to rest fucking Jack Wiltshire so that he can play England qualifiers.
No, but you're
talking... I can't imagine why that would be the case with NBA clubs.
Well, but the thing is, the NBA does determine when free agency is, when all the off-season stuff is. So they would just say, if it's a World Championships year, free agency starts here and finishes here, and it's all done and dusted, so we've got plenty of airtime for the world champs. They'd easily manipulate it.
But that stuff isn't determined by the NBA. It's determined by the collective bargaining agreement. So I think
that if they decided to pull out of the Olympics and go into a world championships, they would write it into the collective bargaining agreement so that it was essentially part of the NBA season, not a separate thing.
Yeah, because it was almost like international windows in European football.
Yeah, that's right. They would have to write it in so that, you know, and for them it's awesome because you would have free agency and then you would have, you know, qualifiers this year, and next year you would have the world champs. And like, essentially you'd have a 12-month basketball season, which is, you know, maybe not a 12-month playing basketball season, but you'd have a 12-month of interest in basketball, which is... You know,
what you got with football? I mean, there's no football being played right now apart from crappy preseason games.
But plenty being written.
But there's shitloads going on. You know, there's and most of it's transfer speculation. The thing about transfers and trades and free agency and all those sorts of things, no matter what the sport is, whether it's basketball or football or whatever, that stuff's almost more interesting because it's all theoretical and it's all based on hope.
Yeah, it's all
based on what Dan Lebatard has always called hope trafficking, because that's more powerful than actual reality. The idea that, wow, we could get this guy and he could be the one guy who makes us good enough to go and win things. That is more powerful than, and more entertaining in a way, than actually watching the games being played.
Well, I got my haircut at a barbershop in Logan today, like a real sort of, you know, street urban barbershop with lots and lots of islanders and big beards and, you know, fat fades and stuff like that.
Did you get a tight fade or?
I didn't get a tight fade, no. Nah. But the guy that cut my hair, it was a Philly fan. And, you know, he's like, yeah, it's been a rough
couple... Freshly out of mourning.
It's been a rough couple of years, but, you know, we at least now have some hope. And I just thought... That is so much what the NBA... And like...
We've been saying that last year, didn't we?
My side's in exactly the same spot. I'm like, well, I'm a Suns fan, mate. I'm basically in the same spot that you are in the West, is that there's hope, you know.
We had no hope and now we've got some, yeah.
Yeah, we've got Booker and everyone thinks that he's probably going to be a, you know, top 10 player when he gets good. Let's just hope that he develops.
Fuck, I want a barber who'll talk to me about basketball.
Yeah, we talk Summer League, man. It was awesome.
That's
I got his name. I'll I'll be definitely going back and
good dude. Maybe you can co-host, but I'm a wife. But no, that's the thing that that was one of the criticisms we had of Hinkie's reign at Philly was that it deliberately took away hope for about 3 years.
Yeah,
but they couldn't. All they could do was trust the fucking process, and the process was just fucking. It was like watching an investment portfolio. There was no sport in it. There was no actual tangible fucking success in it. It was just, let's just hope these assets appreciate, which is not the way. We don't sign up for sports fanship for that sort of shit. A few more bits and pieces. I just wanted to say a shout to NFL coach Danny Green's not dead, but Denny Green is. It was a middling NFL coach, but responsible for one of the greatest rants ever put to air. He was the coach of a fairly bad Arizona Cardinals team, who happened to play the I think it was the New England Patriots, who went on to be undefeated in the regular season.
Season they lost the final.
They won everything and lost the Super Bowl, but. Midway through the season, through the regular season, they played the Cardinals. And the Cardinals led them all the way through and then choked at the end and gave the win up. And there was this fantastic rant from Denny Green where he basically said, words to the effect of, you guys have been lionizing these guys, but they were who we thought they were. We'd game planned for them. And we did everything right, and they were who we thought we were, and we let him off the hook. And he was just apoplectic with rage about the fact that he had figured out how to beat these pricks, and he gamed it all out, and it had worked, and then they fucked it at the end. And it was just this brilliant rant.
I have coached games like that where, even the last season I coached, and we're sort of like, okay, we've got to jump this side. And we had a tap-off move, which the players had actually come up with. It was a really good tap-off move. They run it beautifully. The wingers steam through this gap. No one near him. No one even fucking close. And just drop the ball cold. Beautiful pass. Nice soft pass on his chest. Just for no reason drops it fucking cold.
Were who we thought they were.
And our season pretty much went downhill from that point.
Well, maybe you should have had a rant in the post. I love a good press conference rant. You know, Des Hasler smashing a door or whatever.
I've had a couple of little rants post game. Not too many. I just find that it just doesn't. I just don't know whether it has much of an effect.
Doesn't sink in because everyone's already ticked and in their heads about the whole thing.
I've definitely more training. Before training rants, like, I find that's better when you come back to training and you've had time to settle down and watch a bit of film. Usually watching film's really bad for me. It makes me really, really angry. Like, after the game, I'm sort of like, oh, okay, we didn't do this too bad. And then I go and watch, oh, fuck, we were fucking terrible. Oh my God, how do we do that? Oh, I said not to do that. Why are we doing that? So, yes, my rants usually came at training.
Yeah, basically me complaining about why there's shit all over the floor in the house. It's like, why? This is the Lego! Where's the lid for this pen?
Let's go back to the film. Had a lid. I told you.
Where did the lid go? You've used the pen. What have you done with the lid?
And that's just your wife. What do you say to your kids?
That's actually me. That's me talking to myself.
So in the mirror.
Yes.
All right, you got any other rants? No, but have you noticed
that the best rants, generally, to do a great rant, you have to be not a great coach because you have to get into a position where you've lost a game horrifically, so therefore you can do the great rant.
Yeah, I don't agree with that.
There's probably a proportionality. Well, basically,
plenty of good coaches that have lost.
When was the last good Wayne Bennett rant?
Well, I think there would be good Wayne Bennett rants, but I don't think you'd ever see him on film.
It'd be kind of, we're like, well, the thing is, Pop, we always sort of conflate Pop and Wayne Bennett, but Pop is so much better with cameras, and he does Saki, and he does, Arch. He's a very good actor, Pop. He's very good in front of the camera.
He's got his, multiple personalities, but I think too, it's built into the NBA a lot more access to those guys.
There's more cameras at them. Yeah,
yeah. Not necessarily just those quarter time interviews, which is what he's famous for. But like,
well, they're kind of they're comedic set pieces.
Yes,
he
that's
and,
right.
and Craig Sager in particular. Yeah. The problem is that he and Craig, there's a rules of engagement thing where it's understood. But if you've got some sort of junior.
Poor TNT.
Often female sideline assistant who's just getting torched. It's just, it's not fair. And I think he even gets that now because he's very obviously much kinder on some of these people than the ones he's known for a while, that he can actually go into the kind of the two-handed comedy piece that he's got figured out for himself.
Well, I think too, before he'd lash out at the reporter because he thought the actual thing was stupid. Which is not smart, you know.
No, it's insecure.
Yeah, but yeah, I think now he's like, well, it's not going to change. I might as well have a bit of fun with it. So
yeah, I mean, he's a weird looking bloke with chronic acne. So so I can see why he's not that happy about being on television. Speaking of weird looking blokes, just one last thing. We know that the great Claudio Ranieri won the English Premier League with Leicester last year, basically fueled on pizza and beer. Beers on the coach and on the plane and going out and making their own pizzas and all that sort of stuff. Now, the allegedly great Pep Guardiola, late of Barcelona and Bayern Munich, who has come to Manchester City in the off-season, who is going to lay all before him and destroy it, is not having any part of that. He's banned pizza from Manchester City's players. In fact, anybody who looks ever so slightly Freddy Bumba has been exiled from preseason training. They have to go and run their fat ass around the block before he'll even have them in the squad. He does not understand how to win in England.
It's interesting.
I wish him all the worst. Interestingly, one of his best players at Bayern, Frank Ribery, a.k.a. the Zombie, bagged the shit out of him as Pep was out the door. So it might be interesting to see how the much-vaunted Pep goes when he's driving the most expensive bus in all of English Premier League. Because as we pointed out last year, there were individual bench defenders on that Manchester City team that were more expensive than the entire Leicester team.
So just quickly, because we're running a bit long.
We're well over, but we're giving the people what they want.
I'm going to pay a lot more attention to this English Premier League side, because if Leicester, not necessarily win, but if Leicester or another side like Leicester are right up there this season.
If Leicester finish top four,
or another side finish right up there, then it's going to start to make those big clubs think, maybe it's not just spending the most money that's going to win us. Maybe we actually have to have good, coherent coaching plans, good, coherent front offices, have a look at the character of the side.
Yeah, but Arsenal tried that. I mean, you're basically describing Arsenal, and they've actually been the most successful team in the last 10 years, but they haven't won very much. Yep. They've just been second or third all the time.
I just wonder whether, like, Man City, Man U and Chelsea just seem to go, let's go the sort of the blunt stick approach and just smash our way through the door.
Well, certainly City and Chelsea, Man United are being run pretty appallingly. Their front office is not good. I mean, we're talking about the front office that let Paul Pogba go on a fucking free and are now trying to buy him back for 120 million euros.
That's not smart.
That's not the sharpest move you could envision making. The thing about about English football is that they always quote the salaries in pounds per week, which is kind of a tabloid thing.
Yeah, right.
But in terms of the salaries involved are actually about the same as what they get in the NBA. You know, they're talking about 15, 20 million a year.
Yeah, okay.
But the transfer fees are the main, instead of, as with the NBA, where they trade players and they have to make the salaries match for the trade, here it's just, I'm going to give you a bunch of money to buy out that to buy the rights to that contract. That's really what a transfer fee is.
But that's just between, that's got nothing to do with the players though. Isn't that just between the clubs, or does some of that go
to
the players?
No. So what happens is they make agreement between the clubs to buy the contract out. And then almost always there's a there's a new contract that comes in and replaces the existing contract, and they renegotiate the terms, and that's when you get the 30,000, you know, £300,000 a week or whatever that Pogba's on. I tell you who's not on £300,000 a week? Digby Ioane.
Yeah.
Digby Ioane is coming back to play
for the Crusaders
in the Super Rugby in red for the Crusaders.
Now, what do I want to know?
What the fuck's wrong with you cunts? You can't even get your own players back.
What I can't figure out is, does that make him eligible or not eligible for the Wallabies?
It doesn't make him eligible for New Zealand.
He can never play for New Zealand, but...
Oh, he could probably qualify in residency if he hung around long enough.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of those Islander kids who grew up in New Zealand who... You know,
but I'm pretty sure you have to come back and play for a an Australian Super Rugby side. So that's a really, like, he's basically saying, I'm not going to play for the Wallabies. I'm just going to play club rugby,
which is fair enough. And to be fair, going to play for the Crusaders would be kind of cool if you were a rugby mercenary, because they have historically known what they're doing and have been a fantastic sport, fantastic organisation. Having said that, last couple of years, not so much. In fact, Todd Blackadder, their coach, has fucked off. He's gone and taken a bath. He's literally gone to join Bath. It was interesting to say that Ioane was crediting Robbie Deans with the motivation to come back.
Mm.
The coaching job at the Crusaders is open. Robbie Deans hasn't had a gig for a bit.
No,
Robbie Deans was the coach of the Crusaders. Yeah, join the dots. See if you get a picture that doesn't look like Robert Dean's coach.
They've already announced a new coach. It was in that Ioane story.
I didn't read that far.
Yeah. No, they've got a new coach. It was not someone I knew, but it sounds like it was. Dean's has got a sweet job there. He's like director of coaching, isn't it? So you get to
director of traffic.
Get to pull some strings, get paid, and don't get any of the blame for when they lose.
And you don't have to be on television, because he was always shit-ass in front of the camera. Mm. Quick shout, just to say that the Super Duper Rugby semis are on this weekend. The Lions of South Africa are hosting my Highlanders, and the Canes are playing the Chiefs. And if the Chiefs and the Highlanders win, I get a home final in my own city that I probably won't go and watch. So there's that.
You are a mad keen rugby supporter.
Go, oh Highlanders. That's our name.
And on that note, see you next week.
Welcome to the House of Pain!